I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Spring is always a welcome time of year, but it also means we must be more vigilant about ticks and tick bites. We've long been aware of the risks of Lyme disease, but we're now learning that ticks in our region also host other pathogens, including anaplasmosis and babesiosis. And as our climate grows warmer, predictions are the diseases associated with the ticks will spread to other parts of the country. Joining us to discuss ticks, the diseases associated with them, and ways we can prevent the transmission and spread of disease is Larry Dappas. He's Deer Tick Project Coordinator and Entomologist at the Cape Cod Cooperative Extension. Morning, Larry. Good to see you
again. Good morning, Mindy, and good morning, NPR Nation.
And on the phone, Richard Osfeld. He's Disease Ecologist at the Carey Institute in Millbrook, New York. Good morning, Rich. Rick, good to hear you here. And also on the phone, Dr. Stephen Rich, who's a professor of microbiology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Rick, let's start with you. Ticks have been part of the ecosystem for a long time. When did we first start seeing Lyme disease in ticks, and how has that disease spread regionally?
Well, so Lyme disease was first discovered in the late 1970s in Lyme, Connecticut, when there was a cluster of cases of childhood arthritis, an extremely rare disease. And when there's a cluster of a very rare disease, scientists tend to mobilize and try to figure out what's going on. And in this case, this arthritis was a late-stage manifestation of Lyme disease, a disease never before described by science. In the decades since that discovery, the pathogen has been identified, the black-legged tick has been identified as the vector, and a spread of cases of Lyme has ensued, going basically north, west, and south. It would have gone east, except there was the Atlantic Ocean in the way. And so now we have vastly increasing numbers of cases and a much, much bigger geographic area in which Lyme and the other tick-borne diseases you mentioned occur.
Yeah. You mentioned black-legged tick, and we should tell folks for who are going, what is that? That's the deer tick. What we call the deer tick is really the black-legged tick, right?
Well, so initially, so the correct common name, there are rules about naming things because scientists like to make rules and and abide by them so that we all know what we're talking about. And so initially, it was thought that there was a brand new species of tick, and it was called the deer tick. It was given a scientific name, but then about 8 years later, it was determined that it was not a new species, but a very well-described species that was known for a couple hundred years and named back then. So it's the black-legged tick, but doesn't quite roll off the tongue like deer tick does. So many people still refer to it by its outmoded name.
And you've been studying Lyme disease for a number of years. And in 2015, you made a prediction that in 2017 and 2018, we would see major Lyme disease outbreaks in new regions. So what were you seeing in 2015 that made you concerned?
Right. What we've documented here in the Hudson Valley of New York, a relationship between acorn production by our dominant oak trees in 1 year, that leads to explosions in populations of the white-footed mouse, which is a very, very common but cryptic small mammal that lives throughout most of the eastern half of North America. So they explode in populations after a fall of heavy acorn production. And because they are really good source of blood meals by the black-legged tick and also the source of infection with the Lyme and babesiosis and anaplasmosis pathogens, then 2 summers or springs after a good acorn year, we tend to see higher abundance of infected ticks, and that means higher risk of tick-borne disease to people. So we saw a great acorn year in 2015. Last summer, we had the highest abundance of white-footed mice that we've seen in 25 years of monitoring, and we're unfortunately expecting that that might lead to higher than usual risk of Lyme disease this coming spring and summer, essentially starting like now. It's always risky. Lyme disease risk never goes away, but it does fluctuate, and we expect it to be worse than usual this year.
And Steve Rich, you've been researching Lyme disease since 1992, so I want you to chime in here, too, and maybe talk a little bit about the prevalence of Lyme disease spreading over the past 2 decades and some theories as to why.
Was that for me?
Yes.
Sorry. Yeah, so I think one of the things that's led to the proliferation of the ticks is the proliferation of deer. So deer are more abundant in places than they ever were before. So that's sort of created a fertile ground for the spread of ticks. And they have actually spread eastward from a Midwestern focus in Wisconsin and Minnesota. They've spread eastward through Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. One of the things to remember about this, just to back up a step, is this is a zoonotic disease. So that's why Dr. Asfeld's referring to the importance of mice in the cycle, because they're the natural reservoir of the disease, and then we're sort of accidental hosts. Yeah. So one of the things that's happened in the past is we've measured risk of Lyme disease two ways. One, we've looked at the incidence of ticks that are in the wild that are out looking for people to feed on when they're actually looking for mice. And the other is we look at the incidence of disease in people when they show up in a doctor's office or a clinic. An important thing to bear in mind is that really you have to have those two pieces to come together. You've got to have people that wander out into the places where they're going to get bitten by ticks. And that's sort of the forgotten piece of that zoonotic puzzle. Although it's a disease that's maintained or a pathogen that's maintained in the wild, it really requires that people somehow interrupt in that cycle. So it's we got to make that crucial connection between what ticks are out there and who encounters them. So various things can happen. Like not only is climate important, but also weather's important. So if it rains for a week, people don't go outside, people don't get exposed to ticks. So calculating risk of exposure can be a really tricky thing and has to be sort of done on a local level.
Hmm. So Larry, give us a sense then of how ticks fit into the ecosystem on the Cape and Islands and why we have such high numbers here.
Well, it varies actually quite a bit around the Cape. We have 5 years of surveillance data where there are some areas year on year, like Burgess Conservation Area in West Barnstable, very low tick numbers and very low rate of tick infection. And you compare it to something like the Punkhorn Conservation Area in Harwich, where huge numbers of ticks year on year and very high rates of infection and also co-infection, which is an important point we draw to people.
Mm-hmm. So why do you think that is? Why do you think there's higher in that area and not so high in others?
I'll ask Rick to chime in, but I think it probably is most to do with host animal community structure.
Is that right, Rick?
Well, I can't speak to this particular situation on the Cape, unfortunately, although I would love to be invited to come out, especially in the summer, and spend more time there doing science or lying on the beach. But I can say that we do know that from our studies in the Hudson Valley that the community of vertebrate hosts, so these are mammals and birds that the ticks feed on, can have a strong impact on tick abundance and the number of ticks that are infected. So that would be at least one place to look, to ask whether white-footed mice might be particularly dominant in the high-risk area, but perhaps overwhelmed by other species that are not good reservoirs, as Dr. Rich referred to them, in the places where tick infection or abundance might be lower.
Larry, you mentioned co-infection. So are you talking about the other pathogens that the ticks carry?
Sure.
And now we're up to, what, five?
Oh, yes. Yes. And those are the ones we know of. So in addition to Lyme, babesiosis, anaplasmosis, now relapsing fever, Borrelia miyamotoi, which we have found across the Cape. And last spring, Steve Rich and I collaborated on surveillance of Powassan virus, which we found from Falmouth all the way out to Truro.
And what are some of these other ones? I mean, we kind of know what Lyme disease, but I'm not sure everybody's familiar with the other pathogens that we're talking about.
Well, babesiosis is probably the second leading tick-borne disease on the Cape, and probably on the islands. And that one is very difficult because it's kind of like getting malaria. And unlike Lyme, it can be directly fatal. And unlike Lyme, you can contract this even through a blood transfusion. So the third one that we see fairly often now, anaplasmosis, which is a parasite that invades one type of your white blood cells. And in itself, it can be quite serious as well. And it kind of looks like Lyme disease in its clinical presentation. So that can be confusing for an accurate diagnosis. Powassan virus is something completely different. This is something that we know now is that a lot of people can be exposed, and we see in our surveillance data that there's a fairly high rate of infection at some of these places we monitored. And it's kind of like West Nile virus. A lot of people can be exposed and be asymptomatic, but in the rare instances, it goes neuroinvasive. It'll look like meningitis or encephalitis, and that'll land you in a hospital in a hurry. And we've had cases of Powassan confirmed on the Cape.
Mm. Sounds kind of scary.
It is scary.
Yeah. Does either of you want to chime in, Steve or Rick?
Well, I am greatly concerned about this Powassan virus for a number of reasons. I guess luckily it continues to be very rare in terms of the proportion of ticks that are infected with it. Although Larry might know of some hot spots, it would be even more concerning. But also the number of cases in the United States is in the single digits in any given year. Although there's some signs that it might be creeping up, it's particularly worrisome because the ticks that are infected with this virus can transmit to the person that they're feeding on in as soon as 15 minutes after they start to drink your blood. And that's very fast. You know, you have a little bit of a grace period for the transmission of Lyme disease spirochetes, a day or so. So, you know, getting the tick off may not be quite as urgent in that case. But with Powassan virus, what that should tell people is that when you find a tick, it is extremely urgent to remove it because you don't know what it has inside. And if it has Powassan virus, then every minute counts.
Right. So let's talk about that. You find it, and we should say we're talking about the black-legged ticks or the deer ticks. We don't find
Correct.
This in the dog ticks, right?
No.
Correct. So
no.
This is just the black-legged ticks we're talking about right now. So what is the best way to remove a tick? We hear all kinds of different ideas on what the best way. So Larry, what do you tell people? How do you?
Sure, I field calls from people all the time, usually because they have a tick attached to them, and they're trying to get me to verify or validate what they think they want to do to remove it. So you hear a lot of the old wives' tales, things like the Vaseline or the dish detergent or the flaming match trick, which I don't recommend. But really, the best way to remove a tick properly is pointy tweezers. That's that's the only tool you need, not big fat tweezers that'll crush the tick. You just might give yourself a very nasty infection because these ticks contain all kinds of organisms. But you just grasp that tick by the head as close to your skin as you can get it, and you don't have to be Arnold Schwarzenegger and rip it out of your arm or wherever. You just pull gently straight up and it'll pop.
What about twisting it a little? Kind of like, does that make it kind of let go when you twist it?
No, because the beak of this beast is, if you look at it under a microscope, it's very impressive hardware. It's fairly long and it has recurved barbs like fish hooks.
Oh my goodness.
Oh yes.
Wow. So you want to just pull straight up then?
Yes.
Right. And then, all right, Dr. Stephen Rich, a lot of people want to know, hey, that tick that I just pulled off of me, does it have anything? So you guys test for that. So what should folks do if they want to test a tick to find out what it might be carrying?
What they can do is they can go on to www.tickreport.com and they can order a tick report. They'll get a number, an order number, and then they'll attach that order number to their tick and send it in. And then we'll test for several different pathogens, including Powassan. Mm-hmm. I want to back up for a second
Sure.
just to the Powassan case, so the Powassan story. So there are cases, there are sites on the Cape that we find really high incidence of Powassan virus in the ticks. So we could go to a site where we could find 9 out of 100 of the ticks infected with Powassan virus. When we try to rectify that with the small number of cases of human Powassan virus that often make it to the Globe or the New York Times, make it into big publications, I think there's another story to be told, and that, again, is connecting the actual risk with what's out there with what actually manifests in people. I think the early indications are that maybe there's a lot more, excuse me, Powassan virus in the ticks and a lot less disease, which would suggest that maybe this disease isn't as scary as we thought it is. Mm. Maybe the number of people that we see getting sick are actually just the tip, much like West Nile virus, which is quite prevalent in mosquitoes throughout Massachusetts, throughout New England, and yet it doesn't make most people very sick. Most people get exposed and they resolve it quite well.
Mm, that's a good point.
So that's why it's really important to be sampling the ticks that are biting people, mm-hmm. in figuring out what pathogens are involved with those bites. Because if we just look at the ticks and or just look at sick people, we can sometimes get a very skewed picture.
Right. So you want those ticks. You want people to send those ticks in that they're pulling off of them.
We do, because we get two bits of information. One is we get public information about surveillance. We find out where these pathogens are, distributed both in time and space. The other is we're actually finding that it's useful information for the patient to have, or mm-hmm. the person that's been exposed. So while we emphasize that we're not diagnosing disease, if someone has a tick and a very accurate assessment of the pathogens in that tick, they can change the conversation that they have with their physician because they know something about exposure, mm-hmm. disease to which they've been exposed or not exposed.
Right.
So decisions that are made, like, for example, giving prophylactic treatment for things like Lyme disease, those could be more informed decisions if you knew whether the tick that actually bit you was infected.
Right. And Larry, you were telling me before we went on the air that you actually had somebody, I think, in Harwich who had a tick that had four of the...
Actually, it was in Eastham, and they were co-infected with four of the major pathogens. One of the things Steve didn't point out is that when they received a tick at his lab, that person is guaranteed a tick report in 3 business days.
Oh, good.
So a very fast turnaround, very, very accurate. And one of the things we have going for us on the Cape is that with the support of Cape Cod Healthcare, they are subsidizing the costs of testing ticks for Cape residents this year. So for $15, Steve's lab will test it for everything, including PWASA.
Yeah. What does it usually cost?
Steve, I'm going to kick that one to you. You're the price point guy.
So it's usually $100.
Oh, so $15 is a good deal.
Outside the subsidized price.
Wow. All right, we are talking about ticks. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about ticks, the diseases associated with them, and ways we can prevent the transmission and spread of disease. In studio, Larry Dappas, Deer Tick Project Coordinator and Entomologist at the Cape Cod Cooperative Extension. On the phone, Richard Osfeld, Disease Ecologist at the Carey Institute in Millbrook, New York. Also on the phone, Dr. Stephen Rich, Professor of Microbiology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join the conversation. Or you can shoot us an email, thepoint@capeandislands.org. I have an email from Arlene here. She says, as I write this, you are discussing babesiosis, which I almost died from last year. By the time I became alarmed enough at what was going on with me to seek medical help, I was also in sepsis. Until this happened to me, I never associated any of my symptoms with a tick. I am a person who was paranoid about scrubbing down, washing my hair, etc. every time I came in from the front yard. I never found a tick, and all of the public awareness focuses on Lyme. I wasn't concerned when I developed the symptoms that should have alarmed me. We need a broader focus, which is what we're trying to do here, Arlene. And she said, just as an aside, one of the symptoms she had is dots on her legs, on her calves, tiny, almost noticeable red dots, not a rash, and she did have that a few weeks before she was diagnosed. And that's, I guess, kind of, we have focused a lot, Larry, on the Lyme disease part
of
this.
Sure, and we've been trying to break that headline apart by saying it's not just about Lyme anymore. And I've met a number of people that have had babesiosis. I've met people that have had Lyme disease and babesiosis at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead.
I think this raises the email raises a broader point, which is that you know, it's hard to get really reliable statistics about this to be precise, but a very large percentage of people who suffer from Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases were never aware that they were bitten by a tick,
mm-hmm.
And so it's important that we realize that, you know, when you find a tick on you, and, you know, that tick may be tested, and it may tell you something about the pathogens that are inside it that it might potentially have transmitted to you. Let's say you get that report back from Steve Rich's lab that says there were no pathogens in that tick. That doesn't mean that if you start feeling sick a little later on that you should avoid seeking medical attention because you're safe. So it's very important to be careful that if you feel general flu-like symptoms in the general May through July period in most of the Lyme endemic zone, the potential exists for you to have a tick-borne illness, and one should take those kinds of symptoms quite seriously and seek medical attention so that you can be tested and treated properly, diagnosed hopefully very well.
And that's my question, too. If you have these symptoms and you go in, and is there an easy test for all of these pathogens? I mean, is it blood test? I mean, how do they test?
Well, you don't have a medical doctor on your group this morning, so
we don't. Okay,
I think that I think all three of us are consumers of the medical information, and I think generally speaking, and the others may differ with my view on this, that Lyme disease is supposed to be a clinical diagnosis. The other tick-borne disease is somewhat trickier, but mm-hmm. if a patient comes in suffering from one of several flu-like symptoms, one or more, and has a rash of some kind, doesn't have to look just like a bullseye. There's mm-hmm. quite a lot of difference in the types of rash people present with. Then a diagnosis can be made right there in the doctor's office or clinic without a follow-up blood test. Often the blood test is used as a confirmatory mm-hmm. means of providing information on a case of Lyme disease. There are different definitions depending on whether we're talking about a healthcare provider choosing to treat a patient or whether we're talking about the CDC doing what's called surveillance, which is a means of gathering statistics on cases throughout the country. The blood tests are not perfect. There are better blood tests in development right now, so I'm hopeful that within the next few years or even sooner, there will be more reliable and accurate blood tests. It's tricky to diagnose mm-hmm. Lyme disease for a variety of reasons, and that's one of the main problems in this disease and why it's so controversial.
Yeah. All right, let's talk to Bridget, who's giving us a call from Falmouth. Good morning, Bridget. We lost Bridget. All right, let's try Maureen on Martha's Vineyard. Good morning, Maureen.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for letting me speak.
Yeah.
I'll just try to speak quickly because I've had many dozens of cases of new and old Lyme and bullseyes, and my son had it at 18 months old, and my mother nearly died of babesiosis 2 years ago after visiting me on the vineyard, spent 3 weeks in ICU at Yale, and we pulled her back from death's doorstep with 3 transfusions and monitoring. And anyway, my Lyme friends and I here on the vineyard, after so many years of getting symptomatic again every spring, and as you say, not necessarily finding a tick on us, we have come up with a theory. And I would love for a scientist to check this out because it seems to make sense in our lives. We think that the Lyme goes dormant in the winter months and that the symptoms come back in the spring because it makes sense from a biological point of view that why would the bacteria be active at a time when they can't possibly have a vector pass it on in the winter months when there really aren't any vectors around, such as ticks. The ticks are dormant. And we think that the bacteria comes back out from where it's residing in our body, perhaps in a cyst
form,
that's fine.
All right, Maureen, I'm going to say Larry's shaking his head right now, so Larry, go ahead.
Somebody feeding on us, he will then pass it on.
All right, Maureen, Larry's shaking his head. You don't think this is it.
Research it yet, but I love.
Go ahead.
No, it's there's a couple things going on, especially on the islands. One is perception that the ticks are dormant during the winter is not true at all. In fact, our winters out here are fairly mild by comparison to a place like upstate New York or Wisconsin. Anytime you have temperatures above freezing and a break in snow cover, ticks are active. If you look at the cases of Lyme disease by month, as reported by MassDPH, you see cases in January, February. So basically the tick season starts in January, goes to December, and starts up again in January.
I got an email here from Sarah in Nantucket. She says, could your guests talk about the Lone Star tick populations in the Cape and Islands? I had a Lone Star tick on me from Tuckernut Island. I sent it to Dr. Rich, and it was found to be negative for all pathogens. What other infection rates have you found in the Lone Star tick populations?
Steve, do you want to talk about infection rates? And I'll cover the landscape, where the heck these creatures are here.
Right. So we've yet to find prevalence of any of the pathogens associated with Lone Star ticks in great abundance on the Cape or the islands. So Larry will tell you, in a second, that Lone Star ticks are relatively new to the Cape. They are associated with certain pathogens in their range further south, Virginia, et cetera. But we don't find them in the Cape and Islands as yet. So it could be that those pathogens haven't established in the mammal populations that are going to be the zoonotic reservoirs, and that could be a matter of time. It could be that the densities of the ticks aren't high enough, but we don't see a lot of it.
Sure. There's another aspect to this other than pathogens. The bite of a Lone Star tick can trigger an allergy to red meat consumption that can range from hives all the way to anaphylactic shock.
Wow.
And I met a person last summer at Brewster Conservation Day whose dad was bitten by a Lone Star tick on the Cape, went to a family barbecue, had a burger, and a few hours later he was in the hospital with anaphylactic shock. Now, Lone Star is the newest arrival to the tick landscape here. We found it in Sandy Neck Beach Park about 3 years ago. And that's a six-mile-long peninsula, and we found it from one end to the other. So Lone Star basically owns that piece of real estate right now. And it's now spreading outside of the park. It doesn't exactly stop at the gatehouse like cars do. But I did find last fall an established population of Lone Star in West Falmouth along the Shining Sea bike path. And now we've been picking it up in Orleans and Harwich and Marston's Mills. So
it's all over.
It's on the move. Mm. And it's a very different tick. It's a very aggressive biter. This case in West Falmouth last fall, a woman was on that bike path on the grassy area next to the bike trail. And she, within minutes, had 182 Lone Star larval tick bites.
Oh my goodness.
And so the reason I know about it is that her doctor called me asking for advice on removal, because she said, I can't get tweezers on these things. And I said, you need Mr. Old Reliable duct tape. Apply the duct tape to the tick larvae and just peel them off.
And the difference with these ticks is they have great vision. Is that they see you where the other ticks don't?
Deer ticks that are blind and kind of wait for their dinner to bump into them. They're an ambush predator. Lone Star ticks are an active predator. They'll chase you.
Wow. That's a scary thought. All right. We've got an email from Cindy who says, I have questions on the yard treatments that have been recommended to reduce ticks. What sort of chemicals/products are used? Are there any side effects such as harm to other organisms or plants? Plus, should one be careful when hiring a company to do the work? There seem to be a lot of them cropping up. So let's start with you, Larry. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there are several ways to attack this problem. One of them I'd like to call out up front is the use of these little cardboard tubes that contain cotton balls treated with permethrin tick tubes. And they sound like a great idea. The mice steal the cotton balls if they're compelled to and treat themselves. But research by two very good researchers has shown that the tick tubes have no material impact on nymph stage tick populations. And that's one of the biggest problems. These nymph stage ticks are the size of a poppy seed out during the summer months. So for people that aren't sure they were ever bitten by a tick, it may be the bullet you didn't hear, see, or feel. Mm-hmm. I'm a fan of perimeter yard sprays. People talk to me about yard sprays, and I tell them, you don't have to spray the lawn. You know, short grass, direct sunlight, low humidity. Deer ticks hate that habitat. We're finding Lone Star ticks actually have no problem venturing out into those conditions. So we're trying to learn more about this. But you get to the edge where you have brush, leaf litter, shade, high humidity, that's where you're going to find the ticks. So if you hire a commercial applicator, we recommend a spray in late May and late June. And the product we recommend of choice is Talstar, which contains bifenthrin. A couple characteristics about bifenthrin and why I have not a problem recommending it even here on the Cape. Once bifenthrin hits foliage and soil, it's immobilized. It's not going to wash off site into a water body. It's not going to leach into groundwater. It's going nowhere. Soil microbes will eventually break the product down. But that's a way to really reduce the exposure of ticks, because a lot of people, you don't have to go to the punkhorn to get a tick bite. Mm-hmm. Research in Connecticut has shown that a lot of people actually pick up their ticks in their own backyards through activities. You know, ticks and gardening go hand in hand.
Yeah. Rick or Steve, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind jumping in. So there are a couple things about bifenthrin that are of concern. One of them is that it is very, very broad spectrum. So it will kill any arthropod that it comes into contact with. So it's pretty effective at killing ticks, for sure, but it will also kill honeybees and butterflies and spiders and other creatures, arthropods, insects, and non-insect arthropods that we don't necessarily want to be killing. So there is collateral damage with that product. The other thing is that the CDC published a very large-scale study a couple of years ago where they sprayed bifenthrin into thousands of backyards, back and front yards, in three states. And they showed that they were able to reduce tick populations by about 60%. So it did a decent job of reducing tick numbers. But and this might get back to Steve's comment about human behavior as the wild card, that there was no impact at all on either human encounters with ticks. So they were recording data on how often people actually found a tick on themselves or a member of their family, nor on cases of tick-borne disease. So this was a discouraging result, but what it suggests is that just spraying an individual backyard with bifenthrin is not likely to protect your health. At least there was no sign of an effect in this very large study. So we have a lot more work to do in determining how to protect people in their own homes and properties against exposure to ticks.
Mm. Dr. Rich, any other thoughts you want to add to that?
No, other than to say that I think the management strategy for avoiding disease should be thought of as having multiple layers, the first being to avoid ticks.
Mm-hmm.
So if there are spraying or property treatments that prove effective at reducing exposure to ticks, then, you know, by all means incorporate them. There's personal protections, which Larry can tell you more about, that you can do to your clothing and your skin to protect yourself from tick bites. If those break down and you actually get a tick on you, I think it's crucial that you know that you still have a window of opportunity to remove that tick early and avoid the risk of serious disease down the road. Just I think there's flawed logic in thinking that we should be focusing on people that have disease that don't have any record of a tick bite.
Let's take a quick break, and our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. I think we're having some troubles with our phone this morning. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about ticks, the diseases associated with them, and ways we can prevent the transmission and spread of disease. Larry Dappas, Deer Tick Project Coordinator and Entomologist at Cape Cod Cooperative Extension, is in studio with us. On the phone, Richard Ostfeld, Disease Ecologist at the Carey Institute in Millbrook, New York. Also on the phone, Dr. Stephen Rich, Professor of Microbiology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. We seem to be having some trouble with our phones, but email is working fine, so shoot your question to thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Dr. Stephen Rich, you kind of got cut off mid-sentence there before we went to break. So basically you were saying that if the tick gets through to you, there is this opportunity, this window to remove it and find out perhaps what it may or may not be carrying.
Right. And so the message to educate people is do those tick checks. Check your body, check your kids' bodies, check your pets' bodies for ticks and get them off. Because while we often talk about the number of Lyme disease cases that go underdiagnosed, by logic, there are probably also people that get diagnosed with Lyme disease that don't actually have Lyme disease. And so if we could make that connection between the incidence of tick-borne disease and the necessary tick bite, that would, I think, fill in a lot of the gaps in our understanding of these things.
We have an email from a listener in Wellfleet. Cindy, she says, I have a 15-year-old son who's received a heart transplant, and she's very concerned about tick bites, wanting to prevent exposure to disease for obvious reasons. So she has any more tips for prevention?
Sure, absolutely. We talked to a three-phase protection plan, so I'm not one to rely solely upon a yard spray. I think it can reduce the number of ticks that you may be exposed to. But the besides tick checks, the number one tool in my box is the use of permethrin-treated clothing and particularly treated footwear. Hands down, that is going to reduce your exposure to tick bites substantially. And now we've convinced all the major garden centers on the Cape to carry it. So all she would have to do is go down to, say, Agway in Chatham, and they stock the product. But what I found in doing some initial research on the product, that if you put a tick on a permethrin-treated fabric surface for 60 seconds and then put it on a clean surface, on average, that tick is dead in 9 minutes.
Wow.
So very effective, very, very safe. Permethrin has very, very low mammalian toxicity.
Well, that's it. Rebecca is asking, Brewster, is it safe to treat my children's clothes with permethrin to avoid ticks? And is that an effective way to repel all ticks, including the Lone Star?
Sure. It works on Lone Star, I can tell you firsthand.
Yeah, you had that experience.
I had that experience in my truck. EPA's position on this is that permethrin-treated clothing poses no harm to infants, children, pregnant women, or nursing mothers. The National Academy of Sciences did a long-term exposure study where they made assumptions people were in permethrin-treated everything 18 hours a day, every single day for 10 years. And when they rolled up that aggregate exposure, they saw no reason to expect an adverse effect. So I would not hesitate to put my own children. In fact, I have my daughter on the permethrin freight train, and she is now talking to her friends about it.
And this is clothing. We're not putting it on the children themselves. This
no,
is on
it's
their
on
clothing.
Clothing.
Right. That's good to know.
But I think that I would want to reinforce Larry's point that I am always surprised to see so little reference made to the importance of treating shoes and socks.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, it's important to realize that these ticks in the nymph stage, and they're responsible for the great majority of cases of tick-borne disease, they're looking for you and hanging out on the ground or on very low vegetation. They don't climb high, unlike the adults, which will come up to thigh height or so on vegetation if they can. So you're likely to, you know, your first point of contact with a tick is likely to be anywhere from your feet to your ankles.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that's what you've treated well, then you're going to be in much better shape. So it's not just, you know, doing your shirts or your hat or your shorts. You need to get the footwear and socks, and I think you'd be far better off.
That's a good point. All right, let's try to talk to Larry in Chilmark. Good morning, Larry. Larry, are you there? I guess we don't have Larry. All right. Joanne writes, I found a tick on my back last week and still have it in a baggie. Is it too late to send it and have it checked?
Steve, tell her how many hundred years old that tick can be and still be tested.
Right. So we use the same technology that people use to look at DNA and woolly mammoths. So it could be tens of thousands of years old. The clinical relevance might be less because now whatever you were exposed to may have already advanced to past stages where it'd be relevant. But we can still absolutely test it.
According to the CDC, Lyme disease is the most commonly reported vector-borne illness in the United States. Yet we don't have a vaccine for humans. We can vaccinate our pets against Lyme. So where are we on getting a vaccine for humans? Anybody know the answer to that?
There's active research in that area. There was a human vaccine that was pulled off the market years ago,
I think
2002.
Yeah.
But Dr. Richard Marconi down at I think, Virginia Commonwealth University is actively working on a vaccine for humans. In fact, he's going to be one of our guest speakers at a physicians forum that we are hosting May 10th, where we invite all the physicians from the Cape and the Islands to come in, and we bring in the leading cutting-edge researchers to bring them up to speed on what's going on. And Steve Rich will also be one of our guest speakers.
Steve Rich, you established the Laboratory of Medical Zoology at UMass in 2006 as a research platform to provide information to individuals and communities seeking data about ticks and tick-borne illnesses. So what kinds of research are you doing on ticks, and what are some of the findings?
Well, we started initially as just a surveillance program. So we had NIH-funded investigations to look at how newly emergent areas of Lyme disease might differ from areas where it was long established. And when that NIH project came to an end, we realized that so too was ending a surveillance project. So we continued it on and just asked people if they wanted to send the ticks. You know, we didn't have money to, they would have to pay a fee to test it. What's evolved from that is now that we're doing clinical follow-ups on people that have actually been exposed to ticks and different pathogens. So we recently got an NIH award to look at Borrelia miyamotoi exposure in ticks that have bitten people. We're also looking into following up with the Powassan-exposed patients, and as well as looking at the genotypic differences. So there are, people may not be aware, but Borrelia burgdorferi, the causative agent of Lyme disease, actually has multiple forms, and not all of those forms are thought to be infectious. So one of the things we'd like to do is see whether the ticks that contain those different forms, whether there are different outcomes of those exposures in the patients that get bitten by the ticks.
And Rick, you are in the midst of a five-year research project in New York's Dutchess County you're calling the Tick Project. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, creative name, eh? Yeah, we had initially called it integrated tick management, but that didn't roll off the tongue quite so well. So it's now called the Tick Project, and it can be viewed at the Tick Project or just tickproject.org. This is an attempt. This is the most applied problem-solving research I've done in my career. We want to apply our knowledge about the sort of chinks in the armor of the tick life cycle, where they're most vulnerable, to actually reducing numbers of cases of tick-borne disease, and we've chosen Dutchess County in the Hudson Valley as our focal area. And in essence, we're deploying two tick-killing methods that are commercially available and environmentally safe and demonstrated, at least in small-scale trials, to be effective. One of them is a product called a bait box that is a small plastic box that has a couple of holes in the side that allows entry by small mammals like white-footed mice and chipmunks and shrews. They enter this box to get a little food bait, food reward, but in order to get to the food, they have to walk by a little brush that applies a tiny little drop of fipronil, which is the product in Frontline that many people treat their pets with. That's a tick-killing agent, but it's not broadcast in the environment. It's applied only in minute amounts to these mice and chipmunks. That effectively makes them tick-free. The other thing we're doing in these yards is to spray a fungus, a naturally occurring native fungus that kills ticks very effectively. It, too, is a commercial product called Met52. Today is the first day of spraying Met52 in Dutchess County, so this is a momentous day for my research group. And so we're doing those either separately or together. We have a placebo control for both the fungus spray and for the bait boxes. It's a double-blind experiment, so we're applying the scientific gold standard, and we're doing this in entire neighborhoods, not just individual backyards or as many properties within neighborhoods as we can possibly recruit, because we think that risk might not be restricted to the individual property of a particular resident, but perhaps the surrounding properties as well, when you're going out walking the dog or you're going over to a barbecue at a neighbor. So it's an enormous field project. It's an attempt where we're following up on actual cases of tick-borne disease as well as numbers of ticks in the yard and on small mammals and the like. So we're just up and running, and we should start to have results within the next 6 months or so. But as you said, it's a five-year project, about 4 years left.
Yeah, we need somebody doing that here on the Cape, Larry. All right, we have Amy writes, treating ticks requires action on all fronts. What about installing birdhouses for bug-eating birds and planting biodiverse gardens to attract spiders? Would that help?
Spiders are useful for insect management in general. You're not going to have a material impact on a tick population with a spider. They're their close relative. But there are things in the environment that do feed on ticks.
Guinea hens. Don't the guinea hens eat ticks?
Maybe. That's that. Well, that was all the rage in the Hamptons one year because Christy Brinkley and Martha Stewart were both doing it. But Rick actually put one of his students on this project, and she came up with some interesting observations. Rick, do you want to tell us what she found?
Yeah. So you know, there is a cottage industry now in the use of guinea fowl. And it is, as Larry said, it's based on a study that was published. I think it was the first and only scientific study that Christy Brinkley published. It was done on her lawn in the Hamptons. And as Larry mentioned earlier, black-legged ticks generally are fairly scarce on lawns. So I think the choice of habitat was perhaps not ideal. They're more in forests, brushy areas, places with more shade. And she also caged the guinea fowl on the lawn with known numbers of ticks. And under those conditions, guinea fowl will probably eat anything. Mm-hmm. We compared tick numbers in properties that had guinea fowl and against similar properties a fairly close distance away that didn't have any fowl. So no guinea fowl, no chickens. And we found no statistical difference in tick numbers between the two. So it was a modest study. This was a student project. And so I guess I would say that the evidence is weak to non-existent that guinea fowl have a meaningful impact on tick populations.
All right, Peggy's...
There are a few observations of wolf spiders that are actively hunt ticks, but there are no studies, to my knowledge, of whether wolf spiders eat enough of them, and there are enough spiders eating enough ticks to actually control tick populations. But that's a study that should be done.
Yeah, we only have about a minute and a half left, but Peggy says, what about natural predators such as possums?
Possums are... We need more possums.
We need more possums.
They are
okay.
Tick-killing machines. They groom themselves obsessively. And there are other things in the environment that do feed on ticks, like there are naturally occurring fungi and things like that.
All right. Last question here from Meredith. She says, although my dog has a Seresto collar, which should protect her, I'm concerned about the ticks falling off inside her home and then possibly exposing our family. Do we need to tick check our dogs and cats after they come from outside?
Well, that's a good idea. And the Seresto collar, I've talked with a number of people, and they're very happy with, you know, the fact that they get 8 months of flea and tick control. Ticks falling off in the house, Tom Mather at URI has actually looked at this. When ticks fall off an animal indoors, low ambient humidity, they die very, very quickly. So
that's good news. All right. We'll have links to more information on testing and research. We'll also have a link to our series, Tiny Predators, that Sean Cochran did a few years ago at our website, capeandislands.org. Larry Dappas, Deer Tick Project Coordinator and Entomologist at the Cape Cod Cooperative Extension, Richard Osfeld, Disease Ecologist at the Carey Institute in Millbrook, New York, and Dr. Stephen Rich, Professor of Microbiology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Thank you all so much, and thanks so much for the work that you're doing.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.